Hi, I'm Jade, and this is Behind the Science. In this podcast, I went to interview some of my fellow MIBTP students and ask them what fields they're interested in, why they're interested in them, and a recent development that they took a liking to that's been released at the beginning of their PhD. My background is in developmental biology. I investigate chromatin remodeling and its role in lineage specification in stem cell differentiation. Let's jump straight into the interview.
So we are sat in my living room with two bottles of wine on Valentine's Day. And I will get them to introduce themselves now. I have to my left Emma, who is a biochemist.
Hello.
And I have a plant biologist, Litza.
Hello.
And I've got two microbiologists with me as well, Jazz and Betty.
Hi.
What's up?
Everyone said hello. So let's go on to our first human. Hello.
Hello. Hi. I have a background in plant pathology. Mm-hmm. And now for my PhD, I will try to get deeper into the biology of plants.
Yeah.
And how do they, how does their immune system work, and what can we do about plant pathogens and all the stress that plants and crops we cultivate go through.
Yeah.
Plant biology is, I would say, is cooler than it sounds. And
I mean, you're talking to someone who does not give a shit about plants.
But yeah. Yeah. It's developing very rapidly the last few years. We all know about the food security. We hear about all the time how we need more food to feed people because the population is increasing.
There's a food shortage.
Yes, there is. A recent study that I found really interesting. It revolves around a very hot topic, which is that the Earth is warming.
It's not round.
It's not round.
It's warming, though.
It's warming, though. And that means that more water evaporates and more salt remains in our soils, increasing soil salinity.
Okay.
But what does that mean for crops? And what does that mean for the food we are cultivating?
Yeah.
As of today, soil salinization has been recognized as one of the main factors causing the decrease of land area we cultivate. And not only that, salt stress can affect plant growth, the way plants defend themselves, and can completely change the microbial diversity in the soil around the plant root.
Yeah.
As more and more scientists study how plants communicate with the bacteria in the soil, and what is the nature of these bacteria when salt is present.
How specifically did they manage to look at the area around the roots of these plants then? It's not just as simple as taking like a soil sample.
Of course, yeah. Of course it's not. They, in plant biology in general, they take like soil samples when they want to take a look at nutrients, if you want to irrigate more, if you want to put more fertilizer, but this is more complex than that.
Okay.
This network is an underground network that, as we said, completely changes. Think of maybe some beneficial bacteria, for example, simply stop proliferating because there is
it's too salty.
There. Yes, for the salt tolerance, and other bacteria that are salt tolerant take their place.
Yeah.
So as a result, the chemical communication between plants changes as well. They used a very powerful tool called metabolomics.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted an insight into the metabolomic profile of this network. And the field of metabolomics, of course, was the perfect tool because it studies exactly that. It's whatever the bacteria produces to communicate, to survive, its toxins, its stuff they produce to digest enzymes, and whatever you can think of, the list goes on. The main metabolites in their samples were lipids and lipid derivatives.
Has that anything got to do with water storage, perhaps?
That's a very interesting...
like a camel.
I wouldn't say so, but... Maybe, why not?
That's the only metaphor I can think of.
But that's a very interesting thing to say. Yeah, actually, the authors actually stated that the role of lipids in the rhizosphere has been underexplored.
And what types of bacteria did they find?
There were different bacteria species like Bacillus, Roscelomoria, and Pseudomonas, but they all had one thing in common.
Mm-hmm.
They belong to protobacteria.
Okay.
They are known for their high adaptability to salt stress, and previous studies have associated proteobacteria with high salinity. We already know that proteobacteria is the dominant bacteria in saline soils. Why is it a big deal to keep studying about them? So the key in this research was not to verify if proteobacteria are the most abundant bacteria in salt, that salt stress affects plant development.
Yeah.
So if we can isolate new salt-tolerant beneficial bacteria,
mm-hmm.
like strains, for example, in this case, proteobacteria, that this isolates can show huge application potential and can make us reclaim land that we have lost, and thereby can increase global food production.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is a pair of microbiologists that I found. Hello, again.
Hello.
Hi. Why are you doing what you're doing?
Just love bugs.
Lovely stuff.
Pretty much. Do you know what? It's pretty straightforward. I like studying things that cause disease because they're fascinating. Each bacteria is very distinct and very different, and we form the foundation of our understanding of modern medicine on understanding of, you know, these bacterial fungal.
So what's been recently published that's caught your attention?
How big do you think a bacteria is?
Nanometers.
Well, that's kind of what we want to talk to you about today, because one has been discovered this year, which is about the size of a peanut. Unshelled.
That's an important description right there.
We're doing on the world, like, thinking there's like 2 centimeter like bacteria just flopping.
I couldn't say it was 2 centimeters.
Yeah, this laughing goes on for a while. Let me just skip over that and take you to the next bit.
These bacteria are a whopping 2 centimeters.
So you can see them?
Yeah, well, pretty much with your eyes. You don't need a microscope.
These bacteria are just huge. Compared to like what we think of the genome of a normal bacteria cell being about 4 million base pairs with about 3,000 to like 4,000 genes.
Mm.
These have got over 11 million base pairs and over 11,000 clearly distinguishable genes, which is just
enormous.
Well,
enormous.
Considering humans have what, 25,000 genes?
25,000 genes, yeah. I think part of the reason that their genomes are quite large is that they've got replicates of their own chromosome, which is also changing our understanding of bacteria. Bacteria normally tend to have one copy of their chromosome that's free floating.
Yeah.
But these have multiple copies of their chromosome strung along into this one sort of enormous genome.
Floating about?
No.
Is it bound?
It's bound. It's got a somewhat proto-nuclear structure that is actually bound. So it's kind of...
Interesting.
In between the eukaryote and the prokaryote.
It's crazy from the fitness side as well, thinking that they've got these copies of genes, whereas we think of bacteria, like, to get them just to keep a plasmid, it has to be under some really harsh pressures from the environment to make you want to keep this plasmid, which makes it beneficial for it to keep it. Whereas these bacteria have multiple copies in there.
And they're just happily living their lives. And
in the trees?
In the trees. And funnily enough, they were actually discovered 5 years ago, and they sat in a lab until a PhD student started characterising them. So we've divided this taxonomy of life into very distinct categories. We've gone prokaryote, eukaryotes, archaea. And actually, we're starting to find things that are blurring our very understanding of how life originated. Mm. You know, this is something that's not quite your typical prokaryote, but it's definitely not a eukaryote by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah.
And it's aptly named Thiomargarita magnifica.
Obviously, like, it's bridging this gap between your understanding, you know, how closely related prokaryotes could be to eukaryotes, but in terms of significance in the field, is it huge because it's the biggest one that's been found that you can actually see with your eyes? Is it huge because there's so much more potential, like there could be so much more out there that could be similar to this bacteria?
I mean, I think in terms of actually exploiting it for a potential use, it's very much in the early days, and quite frankly probably isn't going to go anywhere other than sort of a curious incident of the giant bacteria.
In the nighttime. That is unshowered. I think you've got to think of it in the terms of, like, we're always trying to discover
new things.
How evolution takes place.
Yeah.
And this bacteria has taken a few major steps on the way to being a prokaryote cell, really.
And the question is, did it, you know, in terms of evolutionarily, was, did it take, which one came first? Do we have a
egg?
Prokaryote, well,
chicken.
The prokaryote or the eukaryote? I mean, most likely that it's always been believed that it's a prokaryotic cell that then developed into eukaryotic cells, and this is the way of saying that link, that watching evolution in action, but it's in the 21st century.
In a mangrove.
In a mangrove, yeah. And also then in a scientist's lab for 5 years.
Yeah.
But I think part of what makes PhD research and things quite fascinating is you get to do blue skies research, where you do science for the discovery element of science.
Moon science.
Which is very cool.
Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. It's been lovely chatting to you. Like, I don't talk to you every day.
Anytime.
Brilliant.
Call me, it's Valentine's Day.
Hello.
What are you doing? What's your vibe? What's your...
What's my vibe? Like, biochemistry and structural biology, so...
Different. Yeah.
Different.
To the others.
Yes, a little bit different. Protein focused. Like, how do catalytic, like, cycles work? You know, how do enzymes function? How do they interact at, like, a molecular level?
Upon starting your, pretty much starting your PhD, is there anything that's come out recently that's going to be, like, more like, just so, like, you could finish in 4 years' time and then be like, oh, that was when this came out, when I first started?
Yeah, so the main thing that has sort of, like, caught my attention, it's caught, like, the whole of, like, structural biology and slightly beyond, like, attention is, like, the release of AlphaFold, which happened about 3 years ago. So every year, or every 2 years, there's this competition where they basically have unreleased protein structures, and then they're using computer programs. So it's how can it go from an amino acid sequence to, like, a folded protein, which is kind of one of, like, the key, like, questions in molecular biology. Going from RNA, which gets centrulated into, like, a single amino acid sequence, and then the folding problem is how do you go from that single sequence into, like, a complex 3D structure that has, like, actual function. They can do this experimentally. They've used, like, crystallography, NMR, cryo-EM, things like that to solve them experimentally. I think there was, like, I'm going to say 100,000, maybe 200,000 structures in the PDB. Computationally, just, like, you put in the amino acid sequence and you get out a structure. It's, like, a massive tool. And AlphaFold have basically managed to do this in line with experimental, like, accuracy. That came out about 3 years ago. And then now, there are basically three ways you can access this information. You can either do it... It's like a massive database which has recently been updated, and it's got about 200 million like structure predictions in it.
Oh, so I could literally put in what I want to predict.
Yeah, so you stick in the name. I did it, like, it took me 10 minutes when I did it, like, last
Ridiculous.
Week. I put in the name of the protein, it comes up, and you get the structure. They're not all there, but it covers like 21 different species, I think. They can't do substrates at the moment.
Okay.
So it's currently all monomer proteins.
Okay.
Because if you go up into like how they interact with other proteins, that's a whole other level of like.
Right, so it's still in development.
It is definitely still in development. So it's currently all monomers. It's best at doing, like, single domain proteins. But all of these things, they come with, like, confidence metrics, essentially. So there's, like, predicted alignment errors, which judge, like, how the different components of the protein are in comparison to each other. And there's another one, I think it's, like, LDDT, which is telling you about, like, amino acids in comparison to each other. So that's the important one for, like, the individual domains.
Yeah.
So there are different metrics. Like, you can't take all of these structures as, like, they're not facts.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like this is definitely how it is, but they have loads of like potential for like structure-based drug design, and you can incorporate them into your research.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they speed up a lot of the process.
But even though they give back significance levels, it's significance levels based on the program. So the program might deem it. Can you trust that?
That's a good question. So a lot of people say that they think it's a lot more trustworthy based on like competition because it's done on like unknown data, and it has managed to predict it with such a high level accuracy on something we know is experimentally
and they've,
like, correct.
They've done wet lab in line with this.
Yeah, so the competition essentially takes like wet lab structures that have been solved, doesn't release them to like the public scientists.
Yeah.
And then you will get given the amino acid sequence and you have to predict it. And it was built using like machine learning.
on like known protein structures and how the different amino acids like patterns and how they're related to each other in space.
Proteins are everywhere when you're talking about the Search Dogma, right? So
mm-hmm.
can you put this in any field?
Any biological field could use this
yeah.
to an extent because it's so easy to use, and so proteins are like the core of like most biological
mm.
processes. And if you understand how they work, you can do like structure-based drug design. You can do it for like designing enzyme functions, so like industrial enzymes, like things that eat plastic.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Cancer drug design as well, I imagine.
Cancer drug design, yeah, exactly. Stuff like that. There's loads of applications for it in any field. You can use, like, you can go online now.
And it's open access.
It's open access.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thank you.
That's okay.
Thank you for that. And I think that comes to the end of all my friends. I don't have any more, sorry. Everyone is now going to say goodbye.
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 Goodbye. Thank you for having us.
Bye.
Thank you. And that's a goodbye from me.
I'd like to thank Litza, Betty, Emma and Jazz for the interviews, and I'd like to thank Renzo for the music.